Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, and welcome to Live Dharma Sunday. If you have called in to listen to this morning's broadcast, please note that all lines have been placed on mute to avoid background interference. If you are joining us from either the Bright Dawn Name site or the Blog Talk Radio site, please note that it is not necessary to call in. If you're experiencing loss of audio or the Blog Talk Radio player is not working properly, please refresh your page and hit the play button once more. It may take a few moments for your browser to complete the buffering process. Once again, welcome to Live Dharma Sunday and enjoy the broadcast. Welcome, everyone, to Sunday Morning Live Dharma. This is Reverend Koyo Kobose here, and I'd like to share with you an article that appeared in a recent publication called Wheel of Dharma, and it was written by Reverend Akio Miyaji of the Orange County, California Buddhist Church near Los Angeles. And I'll paraphrase this article, which I like very much. The title is A Single Rose of Gratitude. It starts out, it must be a true story. A long time ago in Kyoto, Japan, several hundred years ago, there was a famous Ango In Temple. And there was a head monk of this temple who had a good friend who was a tea master, tea ceremony or chanoyu, the way of tea, hot water for tea, the founder of the current Urasenke, one of the major tea schools in Japan, has many centers all over the world now. In fact, my sister Joyce is a tea instructor in that Urasenke school, and their headquarters is in Kyoto, Japan. His name was Sen, S-E-N. So this head monk and the tea master Sen were good friends. They Sen presented the head monk with some rose seeds to plant on the temple grounds. And the monk was very pleased and honored by the gift and carefully planted the seeds in the temple garden. 1 year passed, then another. No flowers appeared from the bush that had grown from the seeds. Another year passed, and finally, after 4 years, a single white rose, beautiful, bloomed on the bush. Although there was only one flower, the head monk was very pleased, and he wanted to share this flower's loveliness to his friend, Tea Master Sen. But because the tea master was too busy and unable to come to the temple, the head monk decided to send the flower to him so he could see it. And so he cut the flower and and carefully wrapped it in a paper bag and instructed one of his disciples to deliver it to the tea master. Knowing that this rose was very precious, the disciple assured the master he would take special care not to damage the flower on the way. However, as he was walking along a narrow path, he accidentally dropped the paper bag when he was startled by a barking dog. He quickly opened the bag to check on the flower and was dismayed to find that the rose had been separated from its stem. Worried and scared, he didn't know what to do, but what could he do? So he put the damaged rose back in the bag and he continued on the way to the tea master's house. Arriving there, he handed the bag to the tea master, saying that this was a gift from the head monk. Very surprised and happy, the tea master asked the disciple to wait outside while he went inside to open the gift. Shortly after that, tea master San came rushing back and excitedly asked that the disciple go to the temple and ask the head monk to come and pay a visit so that the three of them could enjoy the beauty of the flower while having a cup of tea. Of course, the disciple was very uncomfortable and uneasy because he knew this gift had been damaged. But he followed his instruction. He immediately returned to the temple, relayed the invitation, and he and the head monk journeyed to the tea master's place. But the disciple was very concerned about it, and he also thought that it was rather insensitive of Tea Master Sen to invite the friend for tea, knowing and had seen the condition of the rose. It would have been kinder to remain silent, he thought. Anyway, the headmaster and the disciple came to the Tea Master Sen's house. With feelings of dread, the disciple nervously stepped into the tea room. But once inside, he noticed that the broken rose had been very beautifully displayed on a shelf in the alcove. This corner of the room is a very formal, honored corner called the tokonoma in Japanese. It's where maybe a scroll is displayed on the wall, and on the shelf there's always a really nice flower arrangement. The stem was placed in a simple vase, and the flower lay beside it. The monk thought, how beautiful the rose looked, as if the flower had fallen from its stem naturally. He could imagine the sound of the rose as it fell silently onto the tatami mat. All three men spent a very pleasant afternoon looking at the lovely white rose while drinking tea. Now, Reverend Miyagi, in his article, points out that in Buddhism, it is important that we find beauty, okay, find is in quotes, we're able to find beauty and value in all things, regardless of whether it's insignificant or whether it's damaged, okay, damaged is in quotes. It may appear to be damaged, unless you know how to say it. So like the pure heart of the tea master Sen, we too must learn to accept things as they are and not hastily toss them aside as being worthless or broken. Only when we truly appreciate and see the true beauty in all things do we come closer to understanding the real meaning of gratitude and thankfulness. And the article ends in gusto. Yeah, I really like that article. Well, next in our morning broadcast today, we have a guest, Doug Slatton, who lives in Camarillo, California. He is a current student in our lay ministry program. And for today's Dharma Glimpse, Doug San.
Thank you, Koyo Sensei, for the opportunity to participate in today's program. I gave my Dharma Glimpse a title. I'm calling it Mara Rides the Freeways. My Dharma Glimpse is based on my daily commute from our house in Ventura County to LAX, which is Los Angeles International Airport, which is about 50-something miles away from our house. I drive a 10-year-old Nissan Maxima, which, if you'll excuse the Buddhist pun, is definitely the lesser vehicle by LA standards. There are several distinct phases to this drive, each with its own driving challenges, but what is really going on is an extended fantasy in my head about all the other drivers on the road. I don't listen to the radio or instructional tapes, and very little concentration is necessary to do the mechanics of driving, so I can devote the rest of my attention to daydreaming. And there's an old saying, an idle brain is the devil's workshop. I leave the still somewhat rural area of Camarillo where we live, and I head for the 101 freeway going south. The drivers, even at 6 a.m., are aggressive, and when I approach the freeway, I'm often tailgated, usually it seems by a pickup truck. My response is to purposely slow down to 13 miles an hour, hoping to infuriate the gun-toting redneck behind me, and then when I get to the on-ramp, I gun it to 80, cross over to the fast lane, and disappear over the hill into the next city, which is called Thousand Oaks. My first victory. For about the next 20 miles, there is an opportunity for flat-out cruising, and this is where I begin making serious observations about my fellow commuters. Look at her talking on the cell phone. Hang up and drive. Look at the big shot with the tinted windows, probably a lawyer. Successful types arouse feelings of envy. Young people recall unhappy memories of missed opportunities. Old people, well, as long as they're older than I am, they don't really exist. Luxury car drivers, old or young, are in for their share of scorn. When I've made up my mind about someone based on their car and their driving, I am tempted to find a way to pull up alongside and get a confirmatory view of the driver. Sometimes I'm way off, but when it's close enough, then my attitude is vindicated. A classic example would be the other day when I was cut off by a young person in a black BMW. As I got closer, the vanity plate, when deciphered, apparently translated to rich brat, and the lettering on the frame around it said, Daddy's girl. My worldview was complete. Getting back to the drive, the fun is over as we come into the famous San Fernando Valley and the traffic speed slows abruptly. The 10-mile drive through the valley can take as long as the previous 25 miles did. Things get even tighter as the 101 joins the 405, also known as the San Diego Freeway. The next stretch is getting over the Sepulveda Pass and down into West L.A. We come to a crawl, and even though nobody is really getting anywhere, a lot of us change lanes and try to get ahead of each other to relieve the boredom. After getting through Santa Monica and beyond, it's clear sailing until another brief rally takes place at the entrance to the airport. Bewildered travelers trying to figure out where they are slow up the proceedings and get a well-deserved look of disdain. All cab drivers immediately get teleported back to their country of origin. For variety, I have an occasional challenge from a limo driver who is at least a worthy opponent. At the end of my hour-long commute, I arrive at work upset and ashamed of my behavior, vowing that tomorrow will be different. Every day I try to take a lesson and resist the temptation to compete, judge, get ahead. But it's hard and I get caught up in the manic behavior of the other drivers. I try a couple of visualization techniques. One is to imagine all the cars on the road stretching around the world and therefore ultimately going nowhere. So what's the hurry? Another time, I sort of projected myself into all of the other cars around me and had the drivers switch places so that everyone else was in my car. That was kind of neat until I got disoriented and almost hit the car in front of me. So I guess it's time to try and make some sense out of my behavior. I know it's juvenile, pointless, and even a little risky. Based on the flimsiest possible evidence, I am constructing an entire universe and populating with people having personalities I resent and who, most hurtful of all, are oblivious of my judgments. What I think is going on is a full-fledged ego-feeding frenzy. Mara, the Buddhist double, is at the wheel, telling me that the more I can believe that these people are who I think they are, the more I am validated in thinking I am who I am. Trapped in my car with nothing to do but think, I reinforce all the ideas I have about the world and the people in it. The fact that I am so ready to accept the stereotypes I instantly summon up seems to confirm this notion that what is going on is a rather heavy-handed attempt to get me to believe that I'm something special. Taking this one step further, and I thank my wife Patty for pointing this out, This example of my driving behavior is an illustration of what's behind bigotry and prejudice in general. Just as the individual ego needs constant propping up, we as a nation or a society tell each other stories about people we know nothing about that reaffirm our belief in our special place in history. And as a species, we do the same thing to justify dominion over the earth. Here's a thought for my commute this coming Monday, which I got out of Karen Armstrong's book. As in the time of the Buddha, when monks passed each other on the road, when I have an encounter with another driver, I will simply ask in my mind, who is your teacher and which Dharma do you follow? Thank you.
Thank you very much. You know, driving, I think everyone can relate to driving and in one's car. It's quite a lot of associations occurred to me as I was listening to Doug Sun's Dharma Glimpse. And I think it behooves us to look at an activity, an everyday activity that we do, many of us daily, to take a second look at it. Driving for whatever psychological reason sometimes is a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde type of a situation. You can find very kind people turn into demons, impatient demons behind the wheel. You can, and it's just not a matter of awareness either, because everyone knows, oh, I should be patient. I want to be understanding of other rude drivers. They know this, and they're thinking about it, and then 5 seconds later, literally, when some stupid SOB cuts you off, you see red. That's how the trigger, it just is like a reflex. And so, this means that driving is a wonderful opportunity for practice. This is, every time you get in a car, you have an opportunity to practice. And we can reframe and change our attitude and perspective about the driving experience, how we approach it. The times that you do a commute, if you're by yourself, the car is actually a nice meditative space. Often busy people, they find that their commute is one of their most enjoyable times of peace and quiet. I remember a lot of celebrities or sports stars when they drive, by themselves to work. They say they really like that time, when they're all by themselves and so forth. Here's some. I know that some of our lay ministers have said one of their. I'm recalling one who is one of his personal pet projects is to cut down swearing while he drives, and a lot of times he's driving with his wife and his two young boys, and he knows this is a bad example. But he just can't help swearing a blue streak when he, when he's driving, and his whole personal project is how to cut that down, here are some suggestions or options or considerations for all of us. Okay. When you first get behind, get in the car, even before turning it on, the engine on, sit there for a while. Usually we're in a hurry. But pause just for a breath or so as you sit there. And you see the wheel, the steering wheel. Isn't that a nice Dharma wheel right there? Okay. And in fact, not just thinking so, but put your hand on it, palm of your hand, and make that circle. You know, it's nice to have tactile sense and do a physical action. Okay. I'm right behind the wheel. And it's interesting that the Dharma wheel sometimes looks like a mariner's wheel, how to navigate and steer ourselves through the stormy life seas. Well, this is not a boat, but in a car, yeah, same thing. We're on life's highway, you know, and you never know what's around the corner. And so as we start driving, if we do see all kinds of people, it's an opportunity to try to understand, accept diversity, differences, you know. We can't help perhaps stereotyping. How about if you're in a city and you have to stop at a red light? How many of us, when the light turns yellow, we speed up? Not very many of us slow down. You might try that as an exercise. I remember seeing a cartoon about a traffic sign. And it said spiritual zone, okay, instead of school zone. Speed limit, zero. You know, slowing down, not being in such a hurry. It's not that we're really in a hurry to make an appointment or something, but inside we're in a hurry. We see our driving or commute just as the means to get someplace, you know, to go to the store, to go to work. Okay. We don't realize that the journey itself, hey, this is life, you know. So means end. Means equals end. And so as we drive, supposing the light turns yellow, or as you approach the green light, you say, hey, I hope it turns yellow. Come on, turn yellow so that I could stop. Try that as an exercise. And when we do stop at a red light, say to ourselves, hey, what a nice opportunity for a refreshing pause. And we take a breath and look around where we're at. I think Thich Nhat Hanh said, when you see the car in front of you, the brake lights come on. Imagine that those are the eyes of the Buddha coming on. You know, all kinds of, perhaps these are forms of visualization techniques of the Dharma teachings. I remember I devote a whole chapter in my book, Bright Dawn, to driving when I, you know, and I remember when I first met a minister in New York once, first time to meet him, and he introduced himself. He told a real quick story about how he drives in the city in Brooklyn, and one time he was driving home, afternoon commute, he's kind of stressed out, how it is at the end of the day. You're tired, traffic's bad. And then he saw a sign. It was a traffic sign, you know, when they have some kind of construction or when two lanes go to one lane. Apparently there is a traffic sign company called Amida. And a lot of people say, yeah, that's right. I did see the little label there at the bottom of the sign says Amida. And then there's a big arrow with lights that's, you know, that's pointing, okay, merge to the left. And this minister saw, came up to this sign and he saw that. And he smiled, you know, because he was a Shin Buddhist minister. And Amida Buddha is the central point of focus in Shin Buddhism. And we saw that sign, he just immediately relaxed. Here was Amida sign telling him, hey, okay, go this way. And he said he never got stressed out driving after that. That was the stone on the balance scale that was the tipping point. And I wrote him when I wanted to include this in my book, and I said, is it okay, you know, kind of getting his permission, even though I didn't use his name, to use this story, and I want to let him know that I remember that story. And he introduced himself, okay, in New York. And I asked him whether it was still valid, you know, and he said, yes, it had that power, and he still it had that effect. Still, and so forth. So I think, as a form, if you want to call it a daily practice, you know, sometimes the word practice or path, D.T. Suzuki translated that written character as life, as living. You know, our living is our practice. And we shouldn't get discouraged just because we, you know, we should think that, oh, if I do this, and then it should be effective. You can't help but practice, but live every day. And if our karmic situation is such, one of these stones may be the tipping point. Leave that up to nature. Don't worry about it, or whether, oh, I can't stop swearing, or I can't, you know, I've tried all these techniques. I remember another story. I gave a little workshop for mental health social workers, counselors. And she told a story, this one lady, she's kind of an earthy lady. She said, yes, she went to a workshop on relaxation, visualization techniques, calming, stress reduction, and spent a whole day very, very meaningful. And she was leaving, and she was driving home, and she called her friend on her cell phone and was telling her about this wonderful workshop about being calm and everything. And then, I guess, there was a driver that was doing something in front of her. And as she told the story, she yells out to that driver, you know, he can't hear her, but she says, take that friggin' left turn. And she didn't use the word friggin'. And she just did that as a matter of course. And was still telling her friend about this wonderful workshop. And the friend said, do you know what you just did? You know? You swore and shouted at that other driver. And then you went right back to talking about this wonderful relaxation, calming workshops that you took. And that, you know, it was so automatic, her behavior, trigger behavior reflex in driving. Okay. There was no transfer effect. Okay. So I think in a lot of ways, we all need to utilize this these opportunities for reframing or readjusting our perspective. You know, we do something very common every day, like driving, and it is a wonderful opportunity to learn about the Dharma, learn about ourselves. And we may find that, I know, as some people have said, there are too many bodhisattvas on the road. You know, too many wonderful teachers teaching us patience and understanding on the road. And yet, we can say, we could still sometimes put our hands together, okay, to that rude driver. Or I remember one time in Hawaii, we were talking about different everyday gassos, and gassos in a very loose meaning of the word, you know, formal word meaning of gassos, putting your palms, palm to palm together in front of your chest and making a bow, okay, respect of, gesture of respect and gratitude. But any kind of hand gesture, you know, any kind of hand gesture, kind of innovative, creative use of one's hands, okay? And so everyday gassho, one person, a lot of them have to do with driving. And of course, I'm not talking about, you know, one-finger salute. Some people suggested, you know, sometimes when something happens, you want to react. So instead of suppressing the reaction, the negative reaction, you just replace it with a positive reaction, okay? And maybe make the sign language gesture for love, you know, with your fingers, and shoot that out into the world, okay, as your gesture. Okay? And it's kind of a paradoxical gesture. You make that. You know, kind of an sort of assertive gesture, but it's sending out love instead. Okay. Or another person, this person in Hawaii said she used the one-handed gesture of letting in. You know, when you just make that let in gesture when someone wants to merge in, you say, "No, go ahead." And so it's the letting in gassho. Okay. So all kinds of creative ways in which you can use the driving experience into a very interesting experience, despite all the many bodhisattvas out there. Well, that's all for today's broadcast. And we put our hands together, except, of course, when you're driving. Your hands on the wheel. And I thank our guest, Doug Slatin, and I thank all of you for joining us today. Have a beautiful day.